This is Neil Litt for Princeton University Press. I am talking with Gregory Clark, the author of A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World. The book is published by Princeton University Press. Professor Clark is chair of the economics department at the University of California, Davis. He has written widely about economic history. Farewell to Alms started getting attention long before it was published, and I gather that you have been sharing drafts of the manuscript with colleagues and students and posting parts on the internet, and that this has led to some reports in the media, even months before the book was published, which has been very exciting for us, I suspect for you too, and I hope you're enjoying the attention.
Well, it's been a little unexpected. I labor in a very quiet area of economic history, and so it's taken a little getting used to, but I must admit it is kind of, it is fun.
The book is very accessible, and on that point, you wrote in the preface that a simple set of ideas can carry us a long way in explaining the evolution of the world economy throughout the millennia. And what is this simple set of ideas? What's the book about?
Well, the key idea in the book is that you can, in fact, reduce all of economic history, 100,000 years, to just two or three key problems. And the first one is why there was no improvement in material living standards before 1800. And so the first part of the book shows that with just three simple assumptions, you can describe all economic life up till 1800. And then the second key idea is the Industrial Revolution, how that transformed the modern world. And again, you can show that what that consisted of is just some very basic change in the nature of economies. And then the third key issue is why there's so much divergence in incomes between different societies now. And again, the book tries to show that some of that divergence can actually be related to kind of evolutionary pressures that existed in this long kind of Malthusian era that existed before 1800.
Yes. Why did it take so long?
It took so long, seemingly, for societies to emerge from this Malthusian era because the institutions that are necessary for economic growth probably existed as early as ancient Egypt or ancient Babylon. But we actually observed that people responded very differently to the incentives that economies provide in these very early societies. But what was actually happening was that these societies, because they were at this subsistence income level, exerted selective pressures on the population, whereby those who were economically more successful, those who were more patient, less violent, harder working, were actually gradually taking over the populations of these societies. And that we are definitely culturally different from our ancestors of the Stone Age, and we may even be genetically different from these early societies just as a result of the interaction of economic life with the culture of these societies.
Mm. So some people are more successful than others. Why are there some people who are rich and some people who are poor?
You mean at the individual level or at the? Are you talking at the social level?
Well, actually both. But going back to the Malthusian economy, the income distribution that we've had since from the Stone Age to the Industrial Revolution.
Well, what happens, what you see in society, if you go back to the earliest societies, hunter-gatherer societies, income is pretty equally distributed. Then with the Neolithic Revolution, you actually get the appearance of huge stocks of capital and you get valuable land and you get actually very unequal societies developing, much more unequal than even modern societies. And it turns out what makes people successful in these societies are particularly the ability to accumulate wealth, capital, land, the ability to work hard. And interestingly, you see in somewhere like pre-industrial England that these people also were very successful in raising children, and that then led to them increasing their share of the population. But because these were static societies, their children then couldn't find the same kind of place in the social hierarchy and were gradually being forced downwards. And so basically you get the spread of these kind of values associated with success all the way through these societies. And then the argument of the book is that, well, some societies have experienced these kind of pressures much more than others. And so that if you go, for example, I was in Australia recently, you get Australian Aboriginals have had a tragic time since the arrival of European colonists. And one of the possibilities just is that culturally it's very hard for a society like that, which didn't experience this same long kind of pre-industrial history with kind of settled agrarian society, to make that leap into the modern economy.
We have a developed world and we have a what we might call an underdeveloped world. And one of the questions you asked rather late in the book is why isn't the whole world developed? I'm not sure I get the answer. Are we doing something wrong? Is there something the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund should be doing? Is there a cultural barrier? Is the gap between the richest and the poorest actually growing?
Well, one of the great puzzles of world history is that in the pre-industrial era, the gap between rich and poor societies is actually pretty small, and it's mainly maybe at the range of 3 to 1. In our world, the gap is about 50 to 1.
Now, is that because the poor were better off then, or the rich are just so much more better off now?
Well, bizarrely, what seems to have happened is not only have the rich got richer in the modern world, but the poorer societies have actually got poorer. So that now we have, living in the world, both the richest people who ever lived, but also possibly some of the poorest. And that's the result of the fact that modern medicine, modern hygiene has actually made it possible for people to live at conditions that they couldn't have sustained the population at the earlier world. And so the great puzzle then is that the gap between these societies just it's got wider, and it's still getting wider at this present time. And what the efforts of places like the World Bank and stuff like that, they have really been guided by a philosophy that says it's just a function of getting the incentives right. That these societies are all essentially the same, that people have the same desires, the same wants, and if you just provide the right kind of incentive, growth will occur. Now, it actually turns out there are a lot of these very, very poor societies that have better incentives than places like Sweden or Finland or Scandinavia, where the average worker loses something like 50 or 60% of their income to various government taxes. And so the book is arguing that it's almost the universal economic prescription that can't be the explanation of this gap in wealth and poverty, and that it really is a function of the response of people in these societies to incentives, and that response, that kind of cultural response, has a number of elements. I mean, some of it may be traceable to the long histories of these societies. There are also just local variations in the kind of energy you see associated with different societies, but that's what we need to work on if you're actually going to develop these societies. And it's very hard to know how to do that. I mean, there's been actually surprisingly little attention to this. But that 50 years of attempting to reform institutions haven't got us anywhere. So it has to be that there's another answer to these problems.
So what kind of a time frame should we be thinking about for the underdeveloped countries? Might we expect the entire world to be developed 100 years from now, 200, 500?
The worry is just going on the basis of history, just looking at what's happened, currently there's no guarantee that the whole world will develop. We just don't know. I mean, if we just were to observe current trends, then we would have to say, given that people have tried the various policies that they've tried, there's no guarantee that all of the world will actually develop. And the crucial thing is that economic growth in the modern world has become a very unpredictable thing. In the pre-industrial world, economic models work well in terms of explaining riches and poverty. The bizarre thing about economics is that in the world that's the closest to us, because of the importance of these cultural factors, and it's actually become very, very difficult to make any kind of predictions. And that reflects on the various modern economic prognosticators.
Mm. Well, this is a big vision book. You're looking at the entire history of the world through an economic lens. And one of the last attempts at big history was Guns, Germs, and Steels, Jared Diamond's book. So I'm wondering how your view of history differs from his.
Well, for Jared Diamond, I mean, the crucial thing is geography. And geography really is destiny. And he wants to kind of root the modern success and failure of societies in the accidents of geography. And this book is like Diamond in the sense of saying that we can root a lot of the failures or successes of some modern societies in their history. The book is saying is that it's actually the institutional history of the societies that really is the crucial difference, that it's the fact that societies like China have had century after century of kind of settled agrarian life has actually given that society now a tremendous growth potential that, you know, 50 years of communism couldn't eradicate the kind of basic capitalist nature of Chinese society. But that in other places like Australia, where geography doesn't matter anymore now in terms of the modern world, it's still the case that groups such as the Australian Aboriginals have a very, very hard time adapting to the demands of modern capitalist society. And so the difference in the books is that Farewell to Arms is really emphasizing that history does matter, but it's through the history of the institutions and the institutional structure, the existence of markets and capital and things like that over long periods in these societies, rather than it being the geography of the society. I thought one of the nice things about doing the book was that something like the Industrial Revolution is actually, you know, just a tremendous intellectual puzzle. It's amazing that we don't really have any settled idea about why that happened. But it's actually, you know, unlike quantum mechanics or string theory, it's something that the average reader can actually understand and understand the different answers to as well.
Oh, thank you. That's very clear. I'm seeing there's new ideas here, and I assume that they're going to stimulate a lot of discussion and that to some extent they challenge conventional wisdom. So in that sense, there's bound to be some controversy. So I'm wondering what kind of arguments or objections you're encountering as you discuss the book with other people.
Well, I think there are two sources of objection to the book. The first is the book is making a very strong case that institutions really play a very minor role in immediately explaining events in world history. That, for example, that the Industrial Revolution could be explained by the adoption of different tax policies in Britain in 1760. And that cuts against a lot of kind of received economic thinking. Economists like to believe that there are very simple solutions to the ills of most societies. And the book really argues that's a myth and a kind of pre-scientific way of thinking about the world. And then the second reason the book has been very controversial is that the book shows the existence of these pre-industrial selection mechanisms where the successful are taking, economically successful, are taking over pre-industrial societies. And it's impossible, given the data, to rule out the possibility that we are actually genetically different than the people in earlier societies, and that the people who've inherited the earth in societies like China or Britain are actually genetically different from their precursors earlier. And anything that, even though, as I say, the book doesn't say this happened, it just points out that it's impossible to rule out that it happened. Anything like that, of course, is going to be highly controversial. But I really have to emphasize that it's just a matter of honesty to say, you know, this is possible. I myself don't actually think that that is particularly likely, but it's a possibility we have to live with.
We have to consider the possibility, yes. Let's talk about happiness for a minute. You write that income is more powerful than any ideology or religion in shaping lives, but you also report that wealth has not brought us happiness. How do you measure this, and how do you explain it?
Yeah, it's another kind of curious irony that economics is kind of presaged on the idea that the reason we accumulate possessions is to make us happier. But the empirical evidence, just asking people, and that's the only way we can measure these things, is that within any society, people who have more are happier, and people who have less are less happy. But if we look over time, as we've got richer, we haven't got any happier.
Uh-huh.
And if we look across societies, there's very little correlation between income levels and happiness. And it's true that income has really had incredible effects in terms of shaping how we live, the things we consume, the way we conduct ourselves. It makes it very predictable how we're going to live in future. It turns out that there's no evidence that it's brought us happiness. And it's absolutely the case that it's likely that a hunter-gatherer in 100,000 B.C. Is just as happy as the modern person, despite that enormous difference. So in some sense, it says if we want economic growth, if it's, you know, if it's worth having global warming in order to get economic growth, we got to think of it as bringing us something else than happiness. You know, it brings us knowledge, it brings us knowledge about the universe, it brings us science, it brings us mathematics. But the one thing, curiously, is that it actually hasn't delivered on the fundamental thing that people associate with the reason that we engage in economic activity.
Yeah, that's very thought-provoking. I have one final question, if I may, and it's looking ahead. You've completed this big book. It asks some really big and important questions. Is there a next big question that you're looking at now?
Well, I must say I am actually intrigued by the nature of these kind of selective pressures in this long kind of economic interval before the Industrial Revolution. And the question about whether you can really tease out, was it possible that people actually were even genetically changed by this? And I don't know if it's possible to ever figure that out. But I think it is an interesting kind of intellectual puzzle as to whether within historical times there actually has been change in the genetic nature of people. And so certainly that is intriguing. And then a second question that I think is still, in all honesty, left somewhat unanswered in the book is just the magnitude of modern income differences between societies and how it's possible in a world of such rapid communication of ideas, of goods, of other things, to have these unbelievable differences in terms of living standards. And so I think I may well again return to that part of the problem.
Thank you, Professor Clark. I've enjoyed this tremendously.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
I have been talking with Gregory Clark, the author of A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World. The book is published by Princeton University Press.